Shuai Wara Wern. You're killing Quabbada Worm. You're killing Quabbada Worm. Kaya, Kaya.
That's Dr. Glenn Stashuk welcoming you to Noongar country, specifically to Wadjimup, or as it's better known to us Wadjalas, Rottnest Island. Hello, I'm Kirsty Melville, and today on Earshot, we're heading out to Wadjimup, affectionately known as Western Australia's playground, just 19 kilometres off the coast from Perth.
Five.
Basically, it's the lifestyle, really. No cars around, kids can ride their bikes, free to run around, go to the bakery, play cricket on the beach.
Bring the boats down.
Bring the boats. There's normally one of them that has a boat. So they go out and dive, look at the seals, things like that.
Tell your story, welcome, brother.
It's a long weekend holiday here at Perth's playground, Rottnest Island, and luxury boats, tinnies and everything in between crowd the sparkling waters of Thompson Bay. It's the kind of place where an esky and a cricket bat is essential. A beer before midday, as natural as the island's pristine beaches. Ask any West Australian Wadjala, whitefella, how they feel about Rotto, and the responses are reverential. Memories of carefree childhood holidays, making cubbies in the scrub. The freedom of biking down to the bakery for fresh bread. A stolen first kiss on a teenage family holiday. A holiday at Rotto is a West Australian rite of passage. But for Western Australia's Indigenous people, the memories and the stories are very different. So just a quick warning that there's some discussion of strong themes coming up.
And my nan's a very spiritual woman, my Noongar Nana, and she said it's Wara, it's Minditch, it's a sick place. You don't go over to Wadjimup. And so I never came over again.
Dig just a little bit deeper, and not so far beneath its glittering surface, is the history of horror and suffering. In less than 100 years, almost 4,000 Aboriginal men were sentenced to time at Rottnest Island Prison, some as young as 8, some in their 70s. 373 men were buried on the island, some say many more.
It already makes it the largest known burial ground of Aboriginal people in this country, not just in this state or in the southwest, in the country.
The story has to be told.
And I mean, anyway, who wants to go and hear a horror story about people dying in jails or dying in the bloody room that I've just rented? Who wants to hear about that? I've just eating my blooming fish and chips and I'm just drinking a cold beer and now you've loaded this on me.
Are you ready, Jackson? Here we go.
But do people really want to know about that?
Oh, nice! That's it!
I've been out here to Wadjimup countless times, and like most West Australians, I knew Rottnest Island had been home to a boys' reformatory, an internment camp for enemy aliens during the World Wars, and an Aboriginal prison. But really, I knew shamefully little.
They would arrest them on some trumped-up charge, chain them in together in groups of 20 and walk them all the way to the coast. They'd be sent out to Rottnest Island, Wadjimup. Spearing a sheep or a cow was 7 years automatic. And you can imagine the trauma. The worst thing you can do to an Aboriginal person is take away their liberty.
Dr. Noel Nanup, Elder in Residence at Edith Cowan University. I set out to tell the story of this prison, but it didn't take me long to work out that I had to go right back to the beginning of white settlement here in Perth, to June 1829, when the first free settlers sailed into the Derbal Yarragon, the Swan River.
Coming across the sea was this great big bird. The sails of the ships were fluttering like the wings of birds and bringing these people, and they initially thought the people on the ships were ancestors coming back.
I mean, seeing this figure come floating towards us on the Swan River, we actually thought that they were our family members who had passed on, but were now coming back in a spirit form to protect us. Yalagonga and his people who met them on the banks of the river, I mean, you could just imagine the whole... You're seeing this fair-skinned person floating at you on the water.
Totally convinced that they were ancestors that had come back. They'd been under the sea and bleached to the point where their skin was white.
But these visitors didn't leave. Then you realise that there's more, and there's more, and there's more coming.
This is not good. These foreigners are coming onto our sacred river, and a call was sent from Fremantle to the upper swan, Warra. In Noongar terms, Warra means bad. So get your family and get out of harm's way.
And then all of a sudden there are fences going up. People are being pushed out the road. So we were just marginalised. And then they start bringing in a law that provides a judgment over us when we've had our own governance structure for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, which had never changed.
So the sad reality of that, for Aboriginal people, it's the first time that we'd ever been invaded, ever, and didn't know how to respond.
My name's Ivor Hayward-Jackson, Noongar Land and Culture Protector, Chairperson of the Rottnest Island Desk Group, Aboriginal Corporation. About the settlement of Perth in Western Australia, Aboriginal people were used to do physical labour. They were used to be servants. They were treated horrifically, beaten, enslaved. And that is the fact of how this state was first settled in the Swan River Colony. The HM Sulphur brought the 63rd Regiment here, who were infamously known as the Bloodsuckers. They got the name as the Bloodsuckers, I believe, in the Americas, in the Napoleonic Wars and in the Irish Wars. And they were the elite military devils, if you want. Now, they were used on the East Coast, especially in Tasmania, to eradicate blacks, to eliminate them from the land, to give the new settlers access in the most brutal way.
They just cleared the land, blocked the freshwater springs that ran through the city, which means all of the medicinal plants, all of the vegetation that supplied us with the highest quality of food sources and medicine, plus then the animals that lived in those lakes, they've gone. So that was all our hunting ground. It's completely gone within 3 years of settlement.
So what did Noongars do? Well, they had to survive. You know, particularly the men having to hunt for protein and sustenance. So if you see a bullock or a cow or a sheep or a pig and you can't find yonga and you've got a starving family, and we're talking a massive amount of extended family here, it's your duty to feed that particular family. So a lot of the time they would kill what was ever prevalent, a chicken, a sheep. Well, that was against, obviously, the white law. And that's when the conflict really started to come in.
I'll give you an example of a lady called Fanny Bulbuck, and she lived in a little place we call today Claysbrook Cove, and she had a little song line, and she travelled that every day, no matter what. And her song line went from there through where the city is built now and up to Cartagurrup, which is King's Park, and then a fence was put up, and she'd just cross the fence, climb over it, and then a little later someone built a house. Well, the house was built right on the song line, and she walked right through it while it was being built, and right through the building when it had been completed. That was her job. That was her reason to get up in the morning, was to follow her song line and keep that energy alive. She had to get her food, and that's the way she acquired it. So that's just one example. And then there's others of fences being put up, the kangaroos being shot at, therefore they'd hop away, and there were other animals being brought in, replacing them, like sheep and cows, and so Aboriginal people started killing the cattle and the sheep. And if you did that, then you'd be put in jail. And Aboriginal people didn't understand that. They had no idea.
The allegations that they stole a sheep or they stole a pig or they stole something or they were trespassing or something or other, if that sheep or if that pig or if that building is built on their country, they have every right to be able to take what is on their property, because the Noongars never ceded their land to anybody. But people without invitation just came along, stuck up a flag, took the kangaroos and the ducks and whatever they needed, and then had the audacity to turn around and say that the Noongar stole the pig from their property, and it wasn't their property for the Noongars to steal it off. The Noongars never stole a thing. They only took what was rightfully theirs off their property.
Professor Len Collard, School of Indigenous Studies at the University of Western Australia.
As the problem got more and more serious, by 1838, they'd started to set up a prison on Rottnest Island. And that's firmly entrenched in the minds of all West Australian Aboriginal people because it impacted so greatly on all our families.
10 years after settlement, Perth's jails were overflowing with Noongar prisoners who were suffering terribly from their confinement. They have no cultural history of imprisonment. And so it was decided that a prison exclusively for Aboriginal people would be built on Rottnest Island. The first boat arrived at Wadjimup in July 1938 with 6 prisoners on board. There was no prison yet. The prisoners would have to quarry the stone and build that, and so they slept in a large coastal cave. For the first few months, prisoners gardened and cleared the bush, and they were allowed to hunt for food in the afternoons. But conditions deteriorated when Superintendent Henry Vincent took charge. The mining of limestone and building of the prison began. Vincent was loose with his use of the cat-o'-nine-tails, and prisoners worked ruthlessly in the heat, were inadequately clothed in the cold, and were chained together at night. Dr. Glenn Stashuk from Murdoch University, author and director of Black Prison, White Playground.
Regardless of where they were coming from in the state, these lawmen were chained, ankles, feet, and around the neck. Most of them walked great distance to a court system, and then they were tried and given a penalty and walked probably across to the roundhouse at Fremantle.
And then when the roundhouse is full, you'd have men still chained together being forced to march down to the water's edge to get into a longboat. And some of these men had never seen the open water before. If they'd been from the language groups inland, had seen lakes and waterholes, but nothing like this vast bound of water. And they had no idea what this boat was and oars in their hands, and yet they're made to pay attention to this person who they didn't understand and row 15 kilometres.
And depending on the conditions and the swell and the tide, they could take up to 7-8 hours to row across. Seasick, the fear of drowning, the fear of where they were going, the unknown. And they would have been taken to the holding cell, which is still there today.
Unless it's been pointed out to you, you'd probably miss the holding cell, which is still there, right on the beach at Thompson Bay. Karen Jacobs is a former board member of the Rottnest Island Authority, the first and last Indigenous person to hold that post. And she's also a descendant of men imprisoned at Wadjimup.
When the longboats used to be rowed in, they actually used to come in then to Thompson Bay here to only be held in this little cell with the green doors over here. And remember, they're still in chains. We're put into these cells for a number of days until the superintendent of the prison was ready for them to be marched up past him for inspection and then onto the quad for imprisonment. So if you want to have a look, and it's quite eerie. I mean, there's no light, there's no toilet, no bathrooms. The walls are still the same.
Gosh, that is quite small, that cell, isn't it?
It's not nice when you think some of the longboats would contain anywhere from, say, 12 to 22 men.
I have never noticed this cell.
Most people don't. There's no signage up here.
Yeah, a bit of a missing part of the story, isn't it?
Yeah. The other significance is that this sea wall, this was all built by Aboriginal prisoners who actually quarried stone from off the island, the limestone, and then constructed these sea walls during their imprisonment. So if you think these walls have been up since the 1840s, they still stand very strong. And to be constructed by Aboriginal people who did not build in this style with stone, yet they constructed sea walls and buildings made out of stone that they were forced to quarry and then construct.
And so the first mining that occurred in Western Australia in the post-European period, because Noongars were already mining, as is other Aboriginal groups were already mining for commodity and resources. But in the post-European period, some of the first mines were at Rottnest. And here's the Noongars at the cutting edge as prisoners, reconstructing themselves to take on board the capacity to build an opportunity for the Europeans to live in our country. So what else did they do? Well, they laboured to lay the foundation for the roads at Rottnest. If you go to the salt lakes to the west of the settlement, if you have a look at the bridge, that's all limestone blocks that the prisoners built. So they built bridges and roads. They were involved in learning how to extrapolate salt out of the salt lakes. They built the lighthouses. So, you know, when we think about the death and the dying and the horror, that's only one part of it. But hang on, we need to shift the discourse. We need to shift it, but acknowledge it and continue to talk about it. We need to shift it to a more productive, constructive conversation about the contribution that Noongars and Yamanjis and Wongais and Aboriginal people have made to the building of the very foundation fabric of this nation. And Rottnest was the place where this new economy, these new skills, this new contribution began.
Professor Len Collard. By the 1850s, again under the stewardship of the infamous Henry Vincent, an even more brutal era began.
Yeah, Henry Vincent was superintendent twice. There's still a lot of evidence of his workmanship through the Aboriginal labour on the island, the sea wall, the quad itself. A lot of the main buildings on the island are built under his supervision. But he did it in a way that was barbaric. He had one eye, so the Noongars called him Kokobat Dwa, which is one-eyed dog, because he would beat prisoners, he would kick them. There's evidence that he got the clips or something and grabbed one of the prisoners by the beard and ripped his beard clean out. Another time he beat a prisoner to death with a set of keys.
You could just imagine these great big keys and at full force swinging that around and hitting someone in the head, the impact that that would have. Anyway, the prisoner didn't die outright, but laid in agony for hours, according to the story, till he eventually died overnight. They found him in a pool of blood in the morning. And they had an inquiry over that, and that's when they decided that they'd keep a closer eye on Henry Vincent.
Some of the hangings took place in front of lawmen before returning to the mainland as a sort of a warning to the communities that they were heading back into as part of the frontier, to say, if you break the law, this is what may happen to you. And they would watch their countrymen die in pretty gruesome and horrific states. It was hell on earth. He had no problems with shooting prisoners, wounding them if they tried to escape or didn't do what they were told. He originally was the one that chained them up at night with a long pole system, which was stopped. And look, there was about two royal commissions from memory. They never found anything to prosecute him with, but his son, some say, took the blame and his son was charged. So Henry Vincent, he has two plaques in his name. I think they have one of the housings there is named after the superintendent, Henry Vincent, and prisoners died under his watch, and he's commemorated. But these Aboriginal prisoners aren't.
While conditions have become more grim at the Rottnest Island prison, the same could be said for Aboriginal people back on the mainland.
Wagen or York, 2J, Esperance, Albany, Busselton, Bunbury, Dongara, Meekatharra.
Colonisation was rapidly spreading across the state.
Carnarvon, Geraldton, Onslow, Bidgidanger, Broome, Dampier Peninsula, Derby and Fitzroy Crossing.
As you started to head into the Kimberley, it was more lawless. There were a lot of people in the colony that were quite sympathetic towards the Noongar cause or the Aboriginal cause. But as you headed further out into remote areas, people could get away with a lot more. So there were a lot more killings, beatings, shootings, people being arrested for false pretenses. There was no doubt that what it was basically aimed to do, and it was reinforcing what had already been done to some degree down here in Noongar Boodja with the Pinjarra massacre, what happened at York, what happened with Midjiguru, what happened with Yagan and Mundi, who was told basically to bow down or he was going to be wiped out and his mob wiped out, is that was a sense, as they moved through the pastoralist country, of one way to disconnect and completely remove Aboriginal lawmen from their families, to absolutely break the last bastion of resistance. I mean, people like Jandamara and Pigeon and whatnot, they resisted. They resisted full on against the pastoralists and the Pilbara and certainly throughout the Kimberley, because these were very staunch lawmen and there was a lot more resistance and a lot more brutal resistance.
Once when I overheard a tour on Rottnest and one of the tourist guides said to the tourists that were listening to her, the Aboriginals were brought here to Rottnest because they were troublesome on the mainland. And that was horrific to me. What I mean is they were a strong resistance. They were a resistance to the establishment. They were in the way of the hierarchy, and they were the warriors. They fought and died for their country, for their people, in this war that was waged on them. The chains, the hangings, the displaying of Aboriginal men's bodies to ward off other young Aboriginal men from coming near the settlement, heads on sticks, hanging in trees. These are horrific truths that Australia just doesn't want to face, Western Australia especially.
I mean, the words genocide, it's not used in the Australian dialogue, but when you look at it and you say, well, what were they doing in places like Herzl Governor? They're picking the blokes out, separate from the women, and bang. Well, when you look at the strategy that was used in Australia against the Aboriginal, what they do? They got the blokes. And I don't necessarily believe the argument that they're only targeting sort of senior lawmen, so to speak. They were targeting anybody.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the photographic evidence clearly tells us that some of these so-called senior lawmen, they're boys. You know, go look at the photos.
One of the most disturbing photos shows more than 40 men and women chained together at Bidjedanga, just south of Broome. They were walked 700 kilometres to stand trial in Roebourne.
Taking the men from tribal groups who are lawmen, there's a physicality, there's a role that these men play in initiation, hunting, nomadic living, stories, songlines, being the buddhas or the elders of their particular tribal group, and the women have their role. So all of a sudden, the men are gone, taken away for nobody knows how long. Some never come back, as we know. The women had to take that role on, but they're not suited to do that physically, and also culturally, they're not supposed to. So all of a sudden, you've got, you know, a real breakdown in that community. So other men who might not be fully ready to take on the role would have been thrust into it. And then, as I said, it would have been horrific for the women, not knowing when their men are coming back. So the dysfunction was immense, and it was orchestrated. It was about breaking the spirit of Aboriginal law, Aboriginal men, Aboriginal family, Aboriginal construct.
Dr. Glenn Stashuk. More men were arriving at the Rottnest prison now than ever before. And despite repeated warnings and investigations, Henry Vincent's abuse continued. By the 1880s, conditions were at their worst. More prisoners than ever before were being sent to Rottnest as colonisation spread across the state, and for longer. Overcrowding peaked and disease was rife.
And in the cells, you know, 2 by 1 metres, 2 by 2 metres, depending on the size, sometimes 6, 8, 10, 12 men.
There could have been up to 20, 22 men in each one of those cell rooms. One room.
No urinal.
They might have been given a bucket.
Sawdust or straw on the floor.
If that, most of the time they had to sit in dirt.
No beds. Some were originally chained, even when they were sleeping. That was stopped after an inquiry.
They were given a blanket. There was no washing or cleaning.
And there would have been damp conditions, mopped out with a bucket of water, and the straw would have remained wet and damp.
When they knocked off work, if it had been raining like, you know, it has been lately, and they went back to the prison, there wasn't a change of clothes. You didn't go and have a hot shower and, you know, massage to, you know, relieve the weary muscles and aching backs. You were put in the cell with the other prisoners in your wet gear in a cold and damp room, and you're locked up all night. No wonder, you know, there's a lot of people dying in prison here.
And then when they got sick, it just spread right through. So that's what was the biggest killer of Aboriginal prisoners on the island, was measles, influenza.
When prisoners were coming onto the island from Fremantle, they were coming into contact with Europeans that had brought sicknesses and illnesses, you know, colds and flus and dysentery and other diseases that, you know, Aborigines hadn't been exposed to. And so you can imagine, you know, a prisoner comes into the cell, he's coughing and sneezing. All of a sudden he projectile vomits over everybody. You know, he can't control his bowels, so he's got dysentery. You're in that 6 by 10 foot square. Well, where are you going to go to?
The hospital is there, which became the morgue and a place of just absolute horror. We're talking measles, influenza, smallpox, and, you know, the stories of multiple amounts of Aboriginal men just writhing in pain, crying out for their country. And in one winter, 60 died in one, at least in one hit. So you can imagine the horror of that.
And then lots of people dying and being wheeled out on carts and taken to a site and then have to dig a hole and bury them all together in one big hole in the ground. And it's now known as the largest deaths in custody burial site in Australia.
373 Aboriginal men from all over Western Australia died during their imprisonment at Rottnest Island. Maybe more.
The DNA of these Aboriginal prisoners are still in those walls. They're still in the floor. The DNA of their urine and their blood and their sweat and their fear and their tears.
By 1880, half the Noongar population of southwestern Western Australia had been wiped out, either by disease or during clashes with settlers. By 1903, only 34 prisoners remained on Rottnest Island, now annexed to Fremantle Prison. And there was much debate about what to do with both them and the island. It was starting to be talked about as a pleasure resort of being thrown open to the public. And even then, the infamous quad where prisoners lived in squalor and died was being talked about as holiday accommodation. But that's a story for the next episode.
And because of what happened at Rottnest Island, the cause of that has a major effect on every Aboriginal family even today. Within the first 50 years of the quad at Rottnest Island being used as a prison, caused such a major breakdown in our the core of our cultural structure that it almost desecrated cultural practices, especially in the southwest. We don't understand the war that happened within our own shores, with the traditional owners, the first people, trying to protect their country.
The long-term impact has been that Aboriginal people were kept marginalised and outside of that, and the results of that, of course, were devastating for our people, because you could never have a sense of ownership of anything other than our old way. And that's what we're hanging on to, tooth and nail, even to this day. We're viewed as the dregs of society. And nowadays you still get people put in prison because they haven't paid a traffic fine, you know? May even lose their life in there for not paying a traffic fine. Please. It's just dreadful. It's a battle. Constantly it's a battle.
And finally, in 1931, the prison was permanently shut down. And that's when the next murky chapter of this story begins. So do join me for the next episode of Earshot to hear how well Rottnest remembers its history. A clue? It hasn't done a very good job. What would you think if I told you that even now, tourists are still paying to stay in those cells at the quad where many men died? Thanks to David LeMay for technical production today. I'm Kirsty Melville. See you next time.